You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hi, everyone. I'm Hillary Kerr, the co-founder and chief content officer of Who What Wear, and this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. Today on the show, I'm speaking with an incredibly talented writer, producer, and director, Lee Davenport. Lee knows a thing or two about creating compelling content. After years in the entertainment industry producing everything from pop culture shows on VH1 and BET to reality TV and everything in between, her talents landed her at Interactive One. There, she eventually took the role of editorial director of HelloBeautiful.com, where she led the site to record-breaking traffic, and then became the vice president of women's lifestyle programming and video. By all measures, Lee had a highly successful and fruitful career, but still, she knew that she had more to offer, so she quit her job and moved to Los Angeles to pursue a career as a writer and producer. Now, after creating her own series inspired by her life in New York City, Lee's scripted series Run the World is set to premiere on Stars this May 16th. She's also the brilliant writer behind the Wendy Williams biopic that came out in January and the upcoming Netflix movie, The Perfect Find, starring Gabrielle Union. Lee is the definition of a triple threat and a wildly inspiring one at that. Now, on Second Life, it's Lee Davenport. So, for this podcast, we like to start by taking it way back to the beginning. So, Lee, what did you study in school and what did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
I studied English. I was an English major at Spelman College, and I thought I was going to be a magazine editor when I grew up. I think I was hoping to run Vanity Fair or, you know, Vogue or one of the big books, something like that.
So, after college, you moved to New York, and you got a job as a production assistant at VH1 in the news and red carpets department. Such yes. A funny way of saying that, but yes, red carpets. So how did you get that job? And was it what you expected? Was it where you wanted to land? I'm so curious.
I got the job because I desperately wanted to work at VH1. I was very clear that magazines were not going to be the way to go in 2005, which was like the apocalypse of traditional print media.
Oh, yes. Oh, that's a fun time to be on the market.
Yes. Like I did magazine internships my sophomore and junior year in college. And I already had relationships at Time Warner and various places. And I thought I was perfectly set up to get a magazine job. And then like 2005 was the dawning of the age of the internet in a real way mm-hmm. on the publishing business. And so I was kind of like sitting around in my student dorm housing the summer after I graduated, realizing that that was not going to be an option. And that even if it was an option, I probably wasn't going to be employed long if I took a job at a magazine. So I started looking around and I really was intrigued by the programming on VH1 at the time. They were doing a lot of kind of intersection of pop culture history and politics and music, and all of those things very much interested me. And so I am like, there's only plan A. That's just who I am in my life. So it's like, there's only plan A, and plan A is I'm going to work at VH1. And so I spent the whole summer calling anyone and everyone I knew everywhere to get any job. And it just kind of serendipitously, I was in one of those giant suite dorms for the summer where you have like 8 roommates, but everyone's got different rooms. And one of the girls in that suite had been interning at VH1. And the week before my student housing was going to be up, which was when my mom said, if you don't have a job by the time student housing runs up, you have to come home and live in the basement in Chicago. Literally the week before that, Lauren came home and she's like, hey, you know, the girl who's the PA in the department I'm working for is leaving and they need a PA. And she wasn't up for it because she had to go back to college. And so she's like, I'm going to give them your resume. And so I like got interviewed that week. I was the last person they interviewed. I made a 4-page magazine about myself with my resume on the back cover and like a whole page of pitch ideas for programming at VH1.
Wow.
And they called me the next week, 2 days before I was supposed to move to the dorm. And they're like, hey, you've got the job. And I was just like, thank you. Just like, you know, that first like crying, ugly tears of joy. You've saved me from going to Chicago and living in the basement.
A real lifeline.
Yes. And so, you know, I was so excited. And I think, you know, at first, your first job is whatever, it, of course, is what you want it to be because you're so glad you have a job. But it was very different than working at a magazine. Video was very different. I didn't know the language. Mm-hmm. There's so many acronyms and shortcuts. And I was working at Viacom and it was spread out between 3 buildings. And so I was like often running from like 50th and Broadway to 1515 Broadway in the middle of Times Square,
yep,
going to the tape library back and forth. And it was coffee and it was organizing the library and writing, because this is how old I am now, but like handwriting tape labels.
Yeah.
You had this like giant tape desk that you rolled up to, yep, your cubicle and like shoved tapes in it. And like, you know, I would like watch like hundreds of music videos for time codes of someone smiling with no lip flap. And anyone listening who doesn't know what that means is like when someone's on a videotape and they're not singing or talking, but you catch a moment of them and their mouth isn't moving and they don't look crazy. And write down the time code for that moment on a post-it, stick it to the outside of that tape. Now do it for like another 20 videos. So it was just very tedious, detail-oriented, intense work, which of course, like 6 months into it, you're like, oh my God, this is...
How did I ever think this was glamorous?
Why did I think I was going to like this? But it was amazing. I'm so grateful that that's how I learned video.
Right.
Because I was like completely trained in the truest sense of like what video making and what putting together a segment was, because it was my job to find all of the segments for the producer. And then I would beg the producers to just let me sit with them in the edit. If I didn't have to transcribe an interview or something, I would just spend hours sitting on the floor watching them do their edits. And within like 6 months, I was the first and youngest producer in that department to ever be allowed to produce their own segment.
That's incredible.
It was kind of, it was cool. I actually left that job with 3 produced segments with my name on them. And that's how I got my next job.
So let's talk about that next job. So about a year into your stay at VH1, you moved over to BET. So I'm, yes, curious about how you decided to make that move. I always love hearing when people decide like, okay, this is the time, or this is what the impetus for that change was. Like, how did you, yeah, know? And how was the environment different?
Yeah. Well, I kind of got kicked out of VH1. Like, my boss at the time was so supportive of me. He's an amazing guy named Warren Cohen. And he just really thought the world of me. And that job actually was designed to only be a year. You weren't allowed to stay in that position for a year because it was such grunt work. And because you were a PA, what they found was after a year, people hate it and they turn into like a-holes, you know? And so they were like, you know, like this is a one-year job, and then you can go anywhere else in the company, or we'll find somewhere for you to go in Viacom. But like,
that's
you can't
so cool.
sit at this desk. So I was like 8 months into it, and again, like
producing,
produced, you know. And so my boss was kind of like, "Lee, you know, get out of here. We've taught you everything we can teach you in this department. Find something else." And so, you know, I had made some friends in the business at the time, and a friend of mine was like, "Hey, a friend at BET is looking for an associate producer. Go over there and meet." And so I went over with my three tapes, and yep. I, you know, had my interview and impressed. And I was hired there to associate produce on another news and red carpet show, which is just entertainment news. It was like Access Hollywood or Entertainment Tonight
yep.
for BET. It was called The Black Carpet. And that was that. And then I was like a producer. Like, you know, it was completely different. I ran my own shoots. I did my own interviews. I sat and produced all my own segments. I helped build the entire rundown for the show. My boss was great and really trusted me. And when I first signed on, I want to say it was like April, and the BET Awards were coming up, and they were like, "We're not going to take you because you are too new, and we've already budgeted who we're flying out there, and so sorry." And I was like, "Well, if I fly myself out there, can I work?" And they were like, "Yeah." And so I flew myself out there, and I worked the awards, you know, I was 3 months in, and I really showed up and proved. And so after that, I became kind of like their go-to girl. And so that was like a fun job. I flew to London. I was in LA for everything award season. I was at the Super Bowl and the Grammys, and, you know, it was like totally rocking life. Plus, at the time, it was still fun to party in New York.
Yeah.
And having a BET business card, which I'm sure you know is like having an L business card.
Yep.
Basically, you could just like show that to anyone, and it was like currency.
You know? It was. You just would get in wherever you needed to go.
Yeah, you just got in. Yeah. It's like, where are you going? It's like, here's my card. Like, oh, okay. You know? So I was partying, and we were having a fabulous time. It was great and a lot of fun. But that too gets exhausting. I think 2 years into it, it was January, and I was like looking at my suitcase and realizing it was going to be on the floor for like a 30-day span mm-hmm. of like what February felt like. Like Oscars, Grammys, Globes, you yep. know, Super Bowl, All-Star. I was like, I don't want to do this again. I think I always had friends in entertainment who just loved that side. They loved the media side. They loved doing the interviews. They loved bumping elbows with celebrities. I liked the storytelling and I liked the work, but I wasn't really smitten with the lifestyle.
Yeah.
And I was kind of like 24 and like, I think if you don't want to go to the Grammys, this is probably time for you to move on. You know?
Yeah.
Like, you're heading into the time of year that people love the most, thinking, ugh, I don't want to do that again. And so it's like, okay, I think it's time to go.
I'm so impressed also by the fact that you were so young to know, okay, the magazine industry is imploding. I'm going to switch. To know, I am already tired of the Grammys. I need to start thinking about my next move. Have you always been incredibly mature and level-headed? Because I no. was a hot mess at that age. So I'm sitting here just really so impressed by your ability to look at things from 30,000 feet at an age when you can barely look at it from like 30 inches normally.
Yeah. No, I was not what I say. I was incredibly level-headed and mature. I was very ambitious. I always knew like I wasn't where I wanted to land yet. And if I stay here, I'm never going to get there. And I'm very impatient. And I would say at the time, petulant even. You could see your peers, like people who have been in doing this for 10 years. And I'm like, do I want to be them in 10 years? If the answer was no, it was like, it's time to go. You know, like I got to get out. So I think I was more just impatient and probably a little bratty. But I also had amazing mentors. They're mentors, but really friends. And just, I was so blessed to have people who were like, not that much older than you, you know, but older.
Yeah.
So like 7 years older, 8 years older, you know, even 10, still young and cool, who were literally just saying, don't do what I did. Don't stay at BET too long. That's what I did. I didn't get promoted for 5 years, you know, get out of there. And because I was so impatient, I think I just lucked into really great advice from people who were at the point in their careers where they were like, well, if I had to do it again, I would leave. You know, particularly in TV, the saying is, you only get promoted if you promote yourself. The only way to get promoted in these types of jobs is to quit and get hired at a new job at the next level. They never promote you. And so I had that. You always think when you're 24, the next best thing is just right in front of you waiting for you to walk into it. So, you know, that naivety.
Well, still, I mean, I'm just going to point out that you were listening to the advice, which is more than I could say for myself. So credit to you. Okay, so you listened to that advice. You left BET and you became a segment producer for TV One.
Yes.
What does that mean? What kind of things were you working on? How does the hierarchy work? Did you feel like you were doing something that was different and new?
Yes. So that was actually, that was one of those jobs where you take, it's like a 6-month job because it's just one show. Mm-hmm. But it was a countdown show, but it was 100 segments. So it was a big show. And it was called the 100 Greatest Power Moves in Black History. And I liked it because, again, it was historical and it got me a little bit away from like X, Y, and Z rappers' new liquor line. You know, on that show, I did packages about politicians and musicians and actresses. And, you know, I felt like I was getting to storytell more substantial stories. And that was a job that I took as an associate producer and was promoted to segment producer while there, which got me a title bump. I actually think I maybe wasn't even making as much money as I did in the job before, but I wanted the opportunity to show a little bit more versatility on my resume, and I wanted to start making a transition. I felt like I wasn't doing something serious enough. I've always had this preoccupation of like, do I have this shallow existence? You know, I need to be doing something more serious. So I did that show, which was really fun and actually really cool. It was 6 months, but that was like right before everything fell apart in New York City. And so, you know, that's why I kind of laugh. I'm like, oh, well, I'll take that job and then I'll take the next job. It's just then the stock market crashed and there wasn't a next job.
So what did you do? Because that was such a weird time for everyone, especially I think people in media were really hit hard by it.
Yeah, I was like, oh, you know, I think I turned 25. Like, finally, you're not an entry level employee and mm-hmm. you've got enough work under your belt that you're like, this is the moment I'm gonna skyrocket. There was nothing. Literally nothing. And there was nothing for a year or so. So I went to grad school to pursue a master's in media studies. And I cried. And I sat with my friend at the bar down the street. I also moved to South Africa. So
let's talk about that. So during this time, that's when you went to Africa to produce Many Nations One Award?
Yes, it is. I had always wanted to live in Africa. It was just an obsession since I was a kid, just born out of the most basic of African-American feelings of like, I want to go to Africa and find out who I am. And so I had one of the producers when I worked at BET out of the LA office called and was like, hey, I have this project going in South Africa. Do you want to go? I was like, yes, sign me up. And so I just got on a plane. Basically, there's a network that's in Africa called Channel O. And that is their version of BET, if you will. And they were coming up on their BET awards. But the nominees are from all over the continent, not just in one country. Mm-hmm. So we traveled to 8 different countries on the continent to interview awards nominees in their kind of home environment, and like kicking it with their friends or at their favorite restaurants in their various and respective countries. And it was insane and beautiful and eye-opening and traumatic. It's the best thing I ever did, for sure.
So tell me a little bit about your responsibilities on that project and what you took away from it overall.
So that was the first time I was the head person on a project. It was very difficult. It was under really extreme circumstances, but we pulled it off. In general, it was my first time realizing that being the boss wasn't just about being good at your job, mm-hmm. but also was about managing other humans and dealing with other humans' needs, energy, wants, upsets, etc. I think at that age, I was pretty ill-equipped for that part of the job. And so that was like, oh, okay, you know, there's some things I'm going to have to learn in terms of what does it mean to be where the buck falls. And it was a crash course. Literally, it was on me if we didn't deliver that show that the show was not going to air and that was going to not be okay, you know? So
no pressure.
Yeah, no pressure, especially since we're like traveling to 8 countries and getting held up in customs and
like, oh man,
just like the craziest of crazy things, but just good. It was scary because it was so much responsibility on me and it was like, can you handle this? And when ultimately, you know, I feel grateful for all that I learned, for all that I saw, experienced and pulled it off. I'm also grateful because I was kind of like, yeah, I'm still young, you know? I'm no one's hot shot quite yet. There is more to find out.
So you came back from that crazy, intense project and started working on BET's Harlem Heights for 3 months as a story producer and then at Footsteps, which for anyone listening who doesn't know, is a creative marketing agency as a digital content producer. So these are new producer titles on your resume yes, at this point in time. Yeah. So I'm hoping you can walk me through what exactly that means and how the work is different from your previous work as a segment and series producer.
Yes.
I find all of the nomenclature very confusing.
There's so much of it too, right? Like everyone in TV, like we will create a new title for something as soon as we can just to call it something else to confuse everyone about what anyone does. So yeah, Harlem Heights is what I came home for. But that show was created by a couple of my friends and they had developed it and developed the test tape and got the deal done. Like, you got to come home and help us produce the stories because some of my actual real friends were talent on the show too. This was new for me. I'd never worked in reality and I never worked in reality again either.
You got to learn. You got to know to know.
You got to know what you know. but basically a story producer for anyone who like wants to know how reality TV works.
Yes.
That producer who sometimes pops up when people start fighting or when someone breaks the fourth wall is usually a story producer. And what a story producer's job is to get you riled up about things that you probably don't know or don't want to know that someone said about you or is saying about you on camera in another scene or off camera, and we haven't caught it in the scene yet. Playing you against each other, spinning you like a top, and then throwing you in front of the cameras and hope that they get a boom.
So you're an instigator of sorts.
Yes, or the devil, either one. You know, it's just like, and that was, oh my God, it was so difficult for me, particularly because so much of that cast were my friends in real life, you know? And so I'm just like, getting paid to like manipulate my friends emotionally on camera, you know, in hopes that we're going to get some scene work. I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen that show Unreal.
Yes.
Yeah. But that whole like sleeping in the van thing, yep, rolling over with your mic on. And it's like, that's all real. That is all very much like what we looked like. It's a crazy, insane job, which people are excellent at. And I have friends who are excellent at it and do really great work. And I was probably not excellent at it and also did not enjoy it. And I, at that point, was like, I'll never work in reality again. And because it was 2009, I think it was both because of the stock market crash and the writer's strike that had happened in LA. Like, reality was the only television.
Yep.
And networks were loving it because the ratings were so high and it was so cheap to make. And so that kind of felt like an end of an era for me in terms of like what unscripted television meant in New York and for cable networks and what kind of programming was to be greenlit. It really shifted from that point forward for good. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up, you know, after kind of a year of looking for something else, ended up doing that digital producing job at Footsteps because the internet had started to really embrace online video.
Yep.
And I was one of the people who was very much like, this is the new frontier. This is how I can continue to have the career that I want to have. I can make really smart, passionate content for the internet. And this is where everything is going. And I want to do that.
How did that work out?
Yeah, it didn't. didn't work out. One, advertising is very different than working in a media company. There is clients. I don't like those. I didn't know that I didn't like those, but I don't like clients. And so I found it incredibly stifling trying to be creative within the confines of, like, you know, blue chip client demands and needs. There was so much red tape. There was so many meetings about meetings. And, you know, I think I was there for like a year.
Meetings about meetings is the truest statement.
Yes, it's just, right? It's like, wait, let's have a meeting about that call we just had. I'm like, but we were all on it, you know? So anyway, so I did that. And I was like, I got to get out of here. You know, like, I loved Footsteps. It was a Black-owned ad agency. They did amazing work. It was such a great environment. I loved my coworkers. Like, it was the first time I just, like, we were on Varick and Houston, which is a very cool place to go to work. And I loved being down there. And I was still getting my master's so I could just, like, walk to school. I loved, like, everything about it except for I clearly should not have been in advertising.
I loved everything about it except for the job.
Except for the job.
So how'd you plot your next move?
I didn't. That one showed up in an email. Someone forwarded it to me and was like, hey, I think you'd be good for this role. And I went in and met at this company called Interactive One, which was the newly launched digital arm of a media company. So, hey, now we're speaking my language.
Yep.
They bought Black Planet. They had launched several online verticals, amongst them being HelloBeautiful.com, which is where I landed. And they wanted someone to help them produce branded content. And so that sounded really cool to me because I didn't have to manage the clients, right? I just got to spend client money to make cool videos for these websites. And that's what I was hired to do for 6 months. And then I got a promotion I didn't ask for to run Hello Beautiful, like to become the editorial head of the women's vertical. And I was like, but I didn't apply for that job. And I've only been here 6 months. Like, what's happening? They're like, yeah, we think you'll be great for this. You're going to do this now. And that is how I landed there and was there for 7 years building that brand into, you know, what it is now.
So on a side note, can we just talk about the fact that you led the site to record-breaking traffic? That is unusual for someone who does not have a background in digital media. So one of the things that we love to talk about on this podcast is how some of our previous lives and skill sets that we were working on in earlier jobs actually have like tangible translations to future work. So I'm wondering if you think that there was any correlation between your producing background and if that set you up for success in this role, or am I crazy and you just figured it out on the job and it had nothing to do with any of your previous skills?
No, I mean, that was one of those things where when I got in that job, I was like, oh, I get it. This was the plan. It was very much like everything that I had ever done, right? Since running the newspaper in college. It's like, okay, I have an editorial team. We need to produce content. Part of that content also is that we need to produce videos. You know, what's newsworthy? What's entertainment? Who's in that world and doing what? And here are all my contacts from the entertainment world. You know, like everything just kind of came together to set me up to walk into that brand. And it's a site for young Black women that's undefined. And now I've done this stint in marketing. So I understand branding and I understand brand making. And so the pieces really came together. And that was when the internet got good before it got gross.
Yes.
Which was like this 2 to 3 years magical span between like the end of 2010 and like early 2013. There was this like moment where it felt like it was this big diversifier, an equalizer of voices, and people were just creating so much interesting content and sharing. And Twitter was actually a forum for discussion. You know, we were having a blast and we were doing partnerships. Part of our content strategy was we were the Black authority doing content for AOL and doing sharing links with HuffPost and sharing links with Yahoo, who were still companies that were very much segregated and considered Black popular culture to be Black stuff. And they covered mainstream, so they needed a partner in us. And so we were just supplying and this authoritative voice on our culture and our news. And, you know, that's before everyone realized everyone could just cover everything and everything could be clickbait and everything was a headline. And, you know, it didn't matter who wrote it as long as people saw it. And before, right, Facebook took over and your entire strategy became programming for Facebook instead of programming your site. And so, you know, we were having some fun.
So you got promoted again to a big position. What was the title and what were you doing in that new role?
So I was editorial director and I got promoted to vice president of women's program and video.
What does that mean?
Women's programming meant we had our anchor site, Hello Beautiful, which is, you know, what we've been discussing. But we also had a whole like portfolio of women's sites. We owned radio stations, that company. And so we had stations that catered to radio shows that targeted women. We had partner sites that we had brought into the fold, like Sister to Sister magazine. We had Elevate, which was a gospel and kind of Christian-based women's destination. And so it was to oversee how
all of that
up against, the entire women's demo that we served.
Lee, that is a big ship.
It was big, yes.
How did you feel about that?
Overwhelmed all the time. That job was insane because I both felt insanely proud of how I was working, the work that I did, and I believed in our mission and I believed that I had value at there. But it was very, very much like the definition of burnout. You know, you're completely overstretched and I am overstretched and overachieving and exhausted. And, you know, you start to see the signs of just like, oh, I don't have a social life anymore. I'm never home before 10 o'clock. I'm grumpy and not particularly nice most of the time. I was starting to deteriorate. And I think that was also because the internet was becoming a place that I didn't enjoy spending time.
You don't like the toxic soup? I don't understand.
Yeah. I mean, it's like there's moment, right, where you're like sitting in a training from like people at Facebook who are teaching you how to write emotionally manipulative headlines.
It's like being a story producer.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
And you didn't like that job either.
I don't want to be doing this. Yeah. Like, why are you telling me what key emotive words to put in my headline to make people experience a feeling that they don't maybe want to have today so they'll click on this article about someone's new hair? You know, it just was like, we've gone far. You know, we're going really far. It was killing me. And how much work it was killing me, I think, because I started realizing this is not it. There's got to be more. I don't think I'm going to last much longer. You know, it was hitting a breaking point.
So you did what so many fine New Yorkers have done before you, which is in 2016, you quit your job and moved to LA. So tell me about that decision, how long it took from the moment that you realized, I don't think this is for me anymore, to the final catalyst to actually, like, did you have a plan about what you were going to do in LA? I'm so curious.
It took some years to get there because I love New York and never wanted to leave New York and have never particularly been the biggest fan of LA. Just, I never had any interest in living there, you know? And so it was like a very long breakup, you know, with New York. It's like, I had to like pick a fight with it and decide I hated it. Then I had to like convince myself that New York was over and that I was just over it. You know, like we went through many stages of just fighting with my boyfriend that I didn't really want to leave.
Yeah.
But I knew that I had started really focusing on the writing. You know, I had developed 2 test tapes for my scripted project and had met with everyone I could meet that I knew had an in and scripted content. And everyone from person 1 to 100 was like, you have to go to LA. They don't do this here. This is not going to happen for you here. And I was 31 and it was a point where like people were starting to couple up, get married, have babies. get that next big promotion or settle into that next thing or become influencers or whatever the hell was happening then. And so, you know, it's like everyone seems to be finding their thing. And not only did I not see it in front of me, I couldn't even see anyone 10 years ahead of me. I used to always have someone, like I mentioned earlier, like a woman I could look to who was 10 years in front of me. I'd be like, I'm tracking her.
Yep.
You know, the way she's moving, that's where I'm moving. But in the time of the internet, all of those women, like their careers were completely uprooted and overturned. Their futures were uncertain. They were taking jobs that I didn't want to take or competing with me for jobs, you know, in the digital space. And I was like, well, that doesn't look like a fun place to be 10 years from now. And no one has seemed to figure out what it looks like. And I didn't want to be famous on the internet, and I didn't want to brand myself. I didn't want to be famous for my opinions because I have an opinion about everything and one should not want to follow me for that. And so I was like, I think I got to go. And it was just crazy, too, because I'm sure you relate to this, but like the most important thing you get that makes you feel like an adult in New York is an apartment.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Oh,
like,
yes.
When you can finally afford an apartment that looks like an adult human lives in it.
Yeah.
It had a whole two rooms and I even had an outdoor space. And like so much of my identity was tied up into the fact that I had finally been able to get that apartment.
Yeah.
You know, like what had I been doing for the last decade of my life was like, oh, but look where I live. Like, but look, I have a grown up apartment, which thus means I am a grown up,
right.
You know? So all of that I had to make peace with. And I saw a therapist and she helped me a lot get through that crazy time. Ultimately, at the end of 2016, I put in my notice and that was that. And I didn't really have a plan. I had saved some money. And I had a solid bit of change in my 401k that all lasted like 4 months. And I thought I was going to kind of like maybe do some production work. And then, of course, you know, I kind of was getting scouted by women's brands in LA. And I remember meeting with one and I was just like, I can't take another job or I'll never become what I'm supposed to be. You know, I just can't. I cannot come out here and just take another job that's just as intense as the one I just had because I'm insecure about being broke.
Right.
Like, that's not what I came here for. I could have stayed in my old job with my beautiful apartment and my friends and my social life if that's what I was going to do. And so I was so fortunate. An amazing woman named Sheila Marmon hired me kind of like on a monthly retainer to help her answer marketing RFPs and put together programs freelance from home.
Amazing.
And I did that. And that paid my rent and brought me Trader Joe's. And every other waking minute while I was there, I spent writing.
So what ended up from that time period, amongst other things, you had a script for Run the World that ended up opening a lot of doors. Tell me about that time. Tell me about the background and the inspiration for the story, the script process, because I feel like it's like thousands of drafts and everyone gives you different input. So even though I live in LA, I'm not a part of that world. So if you could walk me through some
good
of that.
Good for you. But yeah, so I had the script for Run the World, which at the time was called Ambitious, which is a project I had been working on since 2010. I had left a girls' night in Harlem with my friends and was just, I don't know, impassioned that I felt like people should know and hear the voices of the lives that we were living. Mm. I had such a smart group of women that I spent my 20s in New York with. We all lived in Harlem. We loved it. And we really felt like we were kind of on sacred space. We thought of ourselves as this like new Harlem Renaissance generation. And we worked on all kinds of industries and had all kinds of versions of the Devil Wears Prada story going. And we were dating great guys and not great guys and we're having fun. And the Obamas had come into office and like there's this fabulous black couple. I feel like it kind of like spawned this like weird hysteria. It was like, everyone's like, I gotta get my Barack. And I'm like, guys, there's one of him. But you know, we can find our versions of black love and happiness. But it was, this is like this interesting conversation that was going. At the same time, there was like books coming out about Black women who are successful and how they're dating wrong and need to think like a man. And I remember literally watching a special on like NBC Nightly News with Brian Williams called like The State of Black Women in America. And it was like these four women in Atlanta who all had these great jobs and like these fancy cars and like, but I'm single. And it's like, what's happening? Like, why is this the conversation that's swirling around Black women? Like, why is there this doomsday scenario that having your life together and being ambitious is like some type of sentence to singledom and sorrow and depression? And then you had like the rise of reality TV shows and Black women were throwing drinks on each other and fighting in the clubs. I'm like, who, you know, like, it was just like, this is not the life that I know. These are not the women I know. And representation matters, mm-hmm. you know? And I was like, why do I see everything but us?
Yeah.
I see every version except for us on screen. And I wanted to write that. And so, like I told you, with me, there's only plan A. And so that was it. I was going to write and make the show.
So there are a lot of people who have an idea about a show they want to get made. That doesn't mean a whole heck of a lot. But you are a different sort of person. So I am so curious as to what your experience was like. I mean, you got representation really quickly. Doors started opening. Tell me about that whole process.
I would say a lot of people were very helpful. Again, I love my women friends, and I believe that, you know, your network is always the best place to start. I will say this for any writer who ever listens to this. You have to have a good script. Mm-hmm. So there's that part, right? You can go to all of these panels and you're all the ways that you can network and meet these people and blah, 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 and whatever, whatever. And all of those things are also helpful, but it really is about what's on the page, you know? And I think that what I'm proud about in terms of my journey is how many hours I know I spent working on what was on the page and getting rejected from competitions, but getting those notes back. And even if I thought they were dumb, thinking about them and applying them to what was on the page. I got coverage from anyone I could. I asked for notes. And a lot of times notes are bad, and that's fine. But usually there'll be like 10 bad notes and one or two good ones. Who cares about the bad ones? You take the good ones, you know? It was a lot of that in terms of what I lean into, and people, you know, always ask is just like, you've got to have the substance there. But beyond that, a couple of things happen, right? Some really incredible movements to embrace diverse voices were happening. Atlanta had come on, and Secure had come on, you know, shows that were more representative of experience that was closer to the one I was writing about had been greenlit and hugely successful, right? Which was helpful because Hollywood is kind of a copycat industry
yep.
that looks for its own version of whatever they've now seen someone else take a gamble on that works. And Ava DuVernay had become such a force in the industry, making so much noise about diversity and awareness about, you know, our stories. And so that felt very real. And I think it continues to feel very real that there is a real effort to find new voices, mm-hmm. particularly Black female voices. And so one of my girlfriends that I went to college with, who's a sorority sister, was working at NBC Universal, and how the world is serendipitous. The very first test tape I made for my show in 2010, at the time she was still living in New York as an actress. Subsequently, like 9 years later, she's a big growing development executive and is like, hey, whatever happened to that thing we did back then? As I said, they're looking for Black female stuff. Like, what do you got? You know, and I'm like, oh, crazy you will ask. Don't show them that video, but here's the script that I've been working on like nonstop now. I think it's in good shape. Like, let me know. And like a week later, she's like, yeah, so read your script, loved it, gave it to the team, loved it. Come in. They want to meet you and hear it. And that was how I got my first deal. And because of that deal, right, you have to get a lawyer to negotiate the deal. And then the lawyer gets you a manager, and the manager gets you an agent, you know. And then like the machine starts working, you know, and you're like, oh, wait. Oh, that's what happens next? Oh, you get the manager. Oh, okay. Oh, now you get the agents. The next thing you know, you're like, you know, taking meetings on the Disney lot and taking meetings at the Sony lot. And like now all of a sudden you're a Hollywood person, you know, and that's just kind of how that happens. But you really do have to make your own way into it. I have a friend who I love said breaking into Hollywood is like trying to get into the club and you're in the line And every time you turn the corner, you ask someone, do they know where the door is? And they're like, yeah, it's right up ahead. And then you like keep going in the line and like you never see the door, but people are going in. The line's getting smaller. You're still outside. You've never found the door. And everyone keeps telling you it's around the corner. And I'm like, it's so true. Like, it's so exactly what it feels like. And I do think that what was cool about this part of my journey was it was a huge leap, but it also felt like I was prepared, you know, like in some way, all of the other things that I did prepared me. So sure, the writing style was different in terms of writing narrative, but being on set for a narrative show is very similar to being on set for a reality show, right? Like it's locations mm-hmm. and it's staged and people are going to go do a scene,
yep.
right? And there's hair and there's makeup and there's wardrobe, like, and there's a sound engineer and there's mics to listen to. And going in to edit my series is all very much like listening for all of the things I was listening when I was training to do news and red carpets, which is audio glitches and that mic drop out and where does that music cue belong? And, you know, so it's like I had all these building blocks. They hadn't been put together to build this particular house, but I had all the pieces for the house.
You knew where all of the tools were. Everything was familiar. It was just a matter of assembly at that point.
Yes, exactly.
And also, like, we also have to talk about the fact that, like, you were a staff writer.
Yes.
So you get to LA. You've got your script. You've got Run the World. It's the project. It's a slow process. So you're also writing for TV for the first time on staff. So you're learning that. That yes. feels like a dream job for a lot of people. What advice would you give someone who wants to land a job as a writer on a show?
All writers have their own shows, right? We all have our own things that we want to do. But when you're staffed on something, your job is to be there to help someone else amplify and hone their voice and hone their vision. Your job is to help push them and what they want to do further. And that's just a great skill to be able to objectively learn, mm-hmm. right? Again, you know, most staff jobs are, you know, having a great writing sample, of course, and then obviously networking as well. You know, I had another college friend was sent my script. I didn't know about it. You know, he did get my script through just kind of like agents send you out to staff. But I was picked out of the pile because he knew my name, yeah. you know, for sure. And then, of course, you have to go up and interview and all of that stuff. But it really is about not being afraid to share your creativity, not being territorial about your ideas. You have to be willing, you're kind of willing to like slave to the bigger product, and that product is not necessarily a manifestation of you at all. And so it's like, how can you be creative in a completely kind of unbridled and giving way?
So you were also approached to develop and write The Perfect Find, which is adapted yeah. from the novel of the same name and is slated for release later this year on Netflix. What was that process like? Was it similar to working on a show? Was it totally different?
No, not at all. Movies and TV are completely different. I think had I known what I know now, I should have been pursuing a life in movie writing because it's way more chill. But no, it wasn't. So it's so crazy. That came to me. My manager called and he's like, do you want to meet with Gabrielle Union next week? And I was like, sure, if it's on Friday, because I'm going on vacation. And I hadn't been on vacation since I quit my job in 2016. So it'd been like 2 years.
Yeah.
I finally got my check from the option deal for the show, which was like not a big check, but felt like $1 million to me, like at the time, you know, because it's like been like so broke for so long. And I'm like, we're going to go on this trip, you know. But it's funny. So he's like, okay, well, we're going to send you the galley so you can read it. So I'm like, cool. You know, I have nothing to do but lay at the pool and read a book. And I open up the email with, you know, the PDF of the book. And it was actually written by a woman who I interned for
what?
When I worked at Teen People, one of those magazine what? Summers in college. So it's so crazy when I opened it up. I didn't even know she had written another book, but it was delightful and funny. And so I flew back and I met with Gabby And I just loved her and her energy. And this was the first thing that she was producing through her company, I'll Have Another, with Holly Fleischer, who's also amazing. And then we all hit it off. And that was super fun. I kind of was able to just go off and write it. It's just so different writing movies. It's just you and your script, you know, and no one's involved until you turn a draft in. And when you turn a draft in, you just get notes and then you do another draft. TV is like writing and production by committee at all times. There's like at least 45 people involved in every step of everything, you know. But when you're writing a movie, you can just like go write your movie. And so that was really fun. And then I got to go out and pitch it. And we were able to land it at Netflix. And that was really cool to do also, and just a new experience.
Can we talk about Wendy Williams, the movie?
Oh my God.
Because my God, social media exploded when that project came out. So you wrote it.
Yes, I did.
What was that process like? Did it go the way that you expected it to? I'm always interested in sort of like the construct and the idea versus the reality.
Nothing with Wendy Williams goes the way you expect it to. So, no. It was really wild, though. Like, I took that right after I had my daughter, and they called me about it. And I was like, what? Like, how did you guys find me? But they had read the Gabby movie and I guess like put me in a pile. And they said that they were like, when we find something fun to write, we're going to call this girl, you know? So they call me and I'm like, okay, sure. Why not? They're like, great. We're going to fly you to go meet Wendy next week. I was like, I have an 8-week-old baby. So, okay. I hop on the plane with my daughter and we're like off to New York. My mom flew in from Chicago to take care of her while I go spend the weekend with Wendy Williams and her new post-divorce apartment where she is like, you know, in tears and like Gucci house slippers and a silk robe, like telling me, you know, her whole life story.
Wow.
It's insane. Like, you know, you just are like, I don't think I'm supposed to be here. Yeah. Like, this feels like a private moment that I am like getting to witness. But she's so candid. I mean, she obviously can't be anything but brutally honest about all things, including herself. And so, you know, I met with her and then we would talk on the phone for hours at a time. And I had her book that she had written some like 20 years ago that really chronicled her rise through the ranks, kind of up into the early thousands. So that was a great help. I wrote like a really big, expensive movie. And then they were like, can you write a less expensive movie? And, you know, and of course, like the whole thing was like, oh, and this is going to take like 8 weeks. And it took months and months and months. But then I had to go shoot my pilot, which we shot and then subsequently got picked up. And so I started working on the show. So I had to stop working on it. So you'll see there's another writer credited on the project, Lacey Swartz, who actually I also had just known about because she did this phenomenal documentary about her upbringing, I think called Little White Lie, which if you haven't seen is fascinating. But Lacey really came in and like had to like do the hard work of paring it down. 80 minutes of TV time is not enough time to tell any story about anyone, particularly Wendy Williams. Mm-hmm. So like kudos to her for doing that work also. But it was such a fun watch. And I remember like I watched it with my husband and we were like, that was like a really good Lifetime movie. It was like, it was, right? Like, it was so much fun. We were like, the internet's going to go crazy.
And it did. And it did. So while you're working on all of this, you are still working on your show, Run the World, which is now premiering on Stars on May 16th. You have been working on this. You said 2010 you started thinking about it.
Yeah.
That is dedication. That is a process. We are talking about years of your life. Are you so excited?
Oh, I'm like beyond excited. I mean, it's so funny. I'm one of those people who's never excited the way people want you to be. All along this journey, everyone's be like, oh my God. You know, I'm like, you guys, the show got optioned. Are you so excited? I'm like, I don't know. You know, oh, we sold the show. Oh my God, are you so excited? I don't know. You know, like you're, because there's
so many steps.
Stages. Yeah, there's like so many more things happen, right? Before you can feel justifiably like, I'm okay now, I could be excited. And so like we watched the series with the cast last week. They've now seen all 8 episodes and they were just like cracking up and crying and so happy and so excited. And after that, I was like, okay,
now,
I'm excited. Like, I'm excited. It is 6 weeks until air. And yeah, I'm tremendously excited. I'm so proud of this season. We have cast the most magnetic, electric cast of actors and actresses. They not only are gorgeous to look at, but just incredibly gifted. And it's the show I wanted to make.
So can we talk about that fact? So you're not just the writer. You are the creator and also the executive producer. So everything runs through you. Casting, music, art design, sets, wardrobe, all of it. What parts do you like the best? Because I can only imagine, like, obviously it's your world. This is very near and dear to you. But there have to be some parts that are slightly more engaging than others.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, to your point, you see everything. So, you know, the 8th time you're looking at what the screen for the iPhone that's going to pop up on the table that you're never going to see comes through, you're like, I'm over it, guys.
Someone
like,
else.
I trust that you, yes. Yeah. But there's so much of it that's amazing. And I always say, like, your cast and crew, like when you ever hear people give award shows, like we just have such an amazing cast and thank you to the crew. Like that is such a real thing. It takes, you know, 100, 200 people to pull off a movie or a television show. And everyone's job is very important. And everyone is a specialist, right? Yeah. Like there's all these factions of like nerd people who do the thing that they do, right?
So, in
like,
service of your vision, Lee.
Of your vision.
That is so sexy.
It's crazy, right? You have like nerd prop people, right? Like they're like obsessed with props. Yeah. And they're like, do you want the notebook to be this shade of purple or this light pink, you know? And then you have like the nerd wardrobe people and they're like, we've got every designer on earth. And how do you feel about this brown belt or that brown and black belt? And do you, it's like, you know, it's like everyone's like the nerdiest people, like with the most expert knowledge of the thing that they do. And they take it very seriously. And like, you'll have like, you know, it's like wars on set. Like if, you know, the lighting guy is mad at the sound guy because everyone's more important, you know, it's like, okay guys, like everybody, you know, like, but it's crazy when you realize like how excellent everyone is at their job on a set.
Yeah.
And how serious they take it. And like, they are literally there to bring your vision to life and make you happy.
Wow.
And so I love our cast and crew. You know, in terms of what's fun, wardrobe's always fun. I love production design, and our production design man, Diane Leader, is just like exceptional. The artwork she placed, the textures, the fabrics, the production design was just always incredible. You know, it's always fun to location scout because you're like in someone's $5 million mansion in Manhattan that you'll like never live in, but like get to see. Like we spent 5 days just like posted up in the peninsula because they were closed for COVID. And so they were like, well, we're just closed. So, you know, we shot there like 5 or 6 days. But I love the cast and I love working with day players, which is like Hollywood lingo for people who just do a guest spot on an episode. It's so much fun when you get like some magnificent actor to show up and they're just there for the day and they just have it. They've got the scene. They're bringing it to life. They're giving your main cast, you know, something to work off. They're finding comedy and magic moments. We just had such a great experience. I just could not have asked for a better team, you know, to bring this project to life in the first season.
Well, I love that. So I think it's important for people to talk about mistakes because, you know, it's very easy to look at someone on Instagram and just see like highlight to highlight. It all seems like everything's going perfectly, but we all make mistakes and we all have down days and they're all moments of messiness. And I think the more that we can be honest about that, the better. So I'm hoping that even though we've just had this amazing talk about your incredible, incredible career, I'm sure that you've made a mistake or two at some point.
Tons.
And I'm hoping you could maybe talk about one and what you learned from it.
There's so many. This is like kind of a back earlier in my career when I was at Hello Beautiful. I made the mistake of thinking that my role as a manager meant I had to be isolated from my team. And I think it was because I was a young manager and a lot of the women on my team were my age or older. And I was trying to like attain authority through a facade, right? Like I was trying to get their respect and get them to see me as their boss by like othering myself and creating distance between who I was and who they were on the team. And I've subsequently realized that that completely backfired and, you know, was horrible for creating the kind of real energy of camaraderie that I wanted to have on the team. I had to learn that the best way to build a team is to trust them and to show up for them the way you want them to show up for you and understand that there isn't really hierarchy, right? There's just relationships and acting like the boss doesn't gain you respect. Projecting an image of bossiness doesn't get anyone to see you as an authority in a way that they respect any more so than just being an honest, decent person, explaining to people why you need what you need, meeting them where they are, being in service of them so that they can be in service of you, and treating everyone, you know, the way you really want to be treated. I mean, it's such a basic thing, but I think we often forget when we're in positions of power that at one point you were the person that you're managing and all you ever wanted was to be seen for your value and to be treated with decency and respect and love.
So a lot of the people who listen to this podcast are in their first life. They are interested in making an industry leap, career switch. Maybe it's big, maybe it's small, something. As someone who has done this quite successfully, I'm wondering if you have any advice for someone who wants to do that next thing, but just hasn't quite gotten there yet.
Yeah. I mean, there's actually a quote in the show that I always go back to, which is like, we're all so quick to tell people to like jump off the cliff, you know, just take the leap of faith, just jump out there, you know, and that's true. If you're ever going to make a change in your life, right, you do have to take that initial jump. You have to take the risk and sometimes throw it out to the wind. But you have to also know that after you jump, there's some time you're going to be in midair and you don't know what's going to happen and what that's going to feel like and where you're going to land. And if you're going to land hard or if you're going to land soft or if you're going to take off flying before you hit the ground. No one can predict that for you. So you have to prepare yourself for the post leap. It's not the big jump, right? It's the after you flung yourself off the thing that you have to think about. And you have to prepare yourself mentally and emotionally for enduring. Because it's that time that gets you to the other side, right? It's not the big jump. It's the falling off the cliff and figuring out if you land hard, how to pick up the pieces and get back up and start walking. You know, if you land soft, how to roll over and help somebody and bring them with you. Whatever your story is going to be, it's going to be uniquely your story. And you've got to be willing and prepared to know that after you jump, it's up to you to make what happens next happen. And that is not going to be comfortable or fast or fun or feel particularly good for a while.
Very honest and very true. Okay, so my last question is also my favorite question, which is, if you could go back in time and speak with younger Lee at any point in her career and give her some work advice, what would you say?
Being a workaholic is not cute. I feel like there was a lot of images of like the working woman, you know, as being this like thing that she wanted to kind of emulate, was obsessed with her job, you know, and it'll do anything, and it'll work the long hours, and like that's the way to be. And yes, there is an element of that that's definitely required of your youth, of like going all in. But I really do have to say I admire these like Gen Z kids who are like, that's not my whole life.
Yeah.
And have like decided to draw different boundaries about what they will and will not tolerate. when it comes to work, because you don't get to go back in time. You don't get your 20s back, you know, and so you don't get to go back and say, wow, I wonder what this would have been like if I was living a healthy and balanced life. Yeah. And not just a life of go, 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 go. You do those things when you're young because you have the stamina and because you can stay out all night and drink a Red Bull and keep it moving. But, you know, I would love to have had some more foresight to say, maybe you wouldn't hit these walls and burn out and have these like total anxiety breakdowns if you could have some perspective that it's a job. It's not your whole life. It's not the only job you're ever going to have. Pull back some, give yourself some air and some time to breathe, you know?
Lee, I have taken up so much of your time, but I am so honored. This was such a delight. Thank you so, so much for spending some time with me, for talking through your career. I can't wait for your show. I wish you all the best.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and I'm so excited to be a part of this. Thank you so very much.
That was the writer, director, and producer, Lee Davenport. For more inspiring interviews with women like Lee, head on over to secondlifepod.com, where we have so many more for you to peruse. If you like today's show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to rate and review us. We love seeing you spread the word on social, so please tag us in your posts. We are at Second Life Pod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We always want to know who you'd like to hear from on the show, so send in your requests to hello@secondlifepod.com, or you can DM us on Instagram. I'm at Hillary Kerr. The show is at Second Life Pod. Our DMs are always open. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of plan, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.